You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
What a wonderful crop, wonderful scene like this.
We're just south of the Coliseum on Normandy Avenue, where people are gathering in a mostly empty room adjacent to a Catholic church. The energy is humming as a group of middle-aged men start to set up chairs in a circle. They're getting ready for their monthly reunion.
My name is Louis Pham. I'm 40 years old. I just recently got out of prison 4.5 months ago after serving 24 years for a first-degree murder that I committed a month after I turned 16 years old.
My name is Byron. I got out of Soledad June 6th. I'm really fortunate to have my freedom again.
My name is Jonathan Barber. I was convicted of second-degree murder for a fatal DUI collision. I served 16 years. I have been out since September 16th.
What was it again? Tony Jonathan, congratulations. How you doing?
For the past decade, changing attitudes toward prison reform have been giving people sentenced to life in prison a second shot at freedom. But even the walk to freedom is a turbulent roller coaster of parole board hearings, months of waiting, and finally, approval from the governor declaring they are suitable to return to society.
Getting found suitable for parole is probably like one of the... I don't know how to explain that, really. I don't. I actually thought I was going to die in prison.
But once someone is found suitable and then released from prison, who is waiting for that person when they get out? For the men in this room on this night, it's other lifers already released from prison. Reporter Lucy Kopp attended a welcome home ceremony for just paroled lifers here at this church, and she brings us this story.
Jonathan is one of the guys being welcomed home today, and is glad to see some familiar faces of guys he met in prison who've been out for months. And now they're here to support him.
For the last few years, I've been around guys who have been on the same path of rehabilitation and redemption. And some of them are out, some of them are beginning to come out. So I knew the gentlemen who came out before me were blazing a path, and it was nice to see some of them there as well.
Up until about a decade ago, a life sentence meant that you'd probably spend the rest of your natural lifespan in prison. Between 1990 and 2000, 97% of people who had the possibility of parole were not actually paroled. You could count on your hands the number of people getting out on a yearly basis. Today, that number pushes 1,000 every year.
The reality is you have a life sentence, so the parole board can essentially deny you and you can die in prison. Fortunately, the public sentiment, the government, the new criminal justice reform movement arose, and the opportunity of getting out for lifers who had been working on themselves manifested.
We know how much we appreciate the community being here to support us.
My name is David Smith, but I'm better known as Smitty.
Smitty is running tonight's welcome home ceremony. He works for Francisco Homes, a local organization that offers transitional housing to those getting out of prison after life sentences. And on evenings like this, Smitty is running around, making sure everyone has a chair to sit in, answering calls and texts from newly released guys who get lost on their way here. Smitty has been on both sides of the ceremony.
I did 28 years, I think it's 4 or 5 months, and some change in days.
Smitty's been out of prison himself just over 4 years, and he knows that when guys get out, unless they have family support, they're pretty much on their own, tossed back into a fast-moving world. So he takes a lot of pride in the position he's in today, to support others in their transition home. And he uses the welcome home ceremony as a moment for him to personally pause and reflect on his own path as well.
When I get to see someone else do it now, it helps me stay centered and focused and remembering how I felt, which makes it, I think, a little bit better for me to communicate to the individual who just came down and like, dude, I was there. I know how you're feeling. Don't worry. We got you.
Every welcome home ceremony begins with announcements, starting with birthday shout-outs.
So we have a few birthdays that have
most of the time, somebody sitting there hasn't had their birthday or their name mentioned in decades. Corinne. So it's kind of nice to be recognized.
45th Milo, happy birthday.
Then it's job opportunities, general housekeeping, and in between each announcement, the audience offers a light applause, and a man sitting in the circle uses a drum. And the drum isn't just a frivolous addition to the evening. It's deliberately tribal. And so is the candle of hope burning in the middle of the circle. The symbolism and ritual, it's all meant to create a lasting memory for the newly released lifers and show guys like Jonathan that they're not alone in this.
Gentlemen, we want to encourage you to take this time of transition to heal and acclimate to life as a free person after spending such a long time away. We welcome you into our community and wish to support you through this process and celebrate your opportunity for a second chance at life.
For so long, it's very easy to entertain the notion that out of sight, out of mind, folks just forget about you. And yet when you get that warm welcoming, that embrace, like they're there to say welcome home, it's very sobering.
The men being welcomed home have a sort of glazed over look, but they listen attentively as Smitty reads their names, one by one.
I want to welcome you home, Antonio Webster, Alonso Gonzalez, Nathan Jones, Jonathan Barber.
Jonathan's not just thinking about his newfound freedom tonight. He's thinking about the reason he's here in the first place, the tragic event, and his victims.
I struggle with conversations where it seems as if I'm being put into the spotlight. What was lost for me to get here? A person's life was lost, a family was fundamentally altered. And for me to be here and to enjoy some things that they're not able to enjoy, I'm very humble and grateful for that opportunity.
A few chairs down from Jonathan is Louis, who shares a similar mindfulness since getting out in May.
Many of us former lifers were incarcerated for murder. So we owe it to our victims to become better people, right? And not only become better people, but create other healing opportunities for others.
Gentlemen, the Francisco Holmes gives you a souvenir, a token, whatever you'd like.
Then each former lifer gets a key.
We give you the key so that you remember.
That key is the symbol that you're now unlocking the door to all the dreams that you had while you laid in the bed, or the bunk, or when you were out on the yard.
And then, as the men study their new keys, a row of candles are laid out to create an illuminated pathway towards the center of the circle.
It is our job to show them how much we support them. So if we can get started, everybody, let's get them going.
The newly released lifers are invited to step over a wooden plank at the end of the candlelit walkway, crossing a symbolic threshold into their freedom and echoing an old slave ritual that was used to confirm a marriage union. Within seconds, the energy in the room elevates with a new lightness as the procession begins.
And it's the opportunity for the guy to come on home. Come on home. You can come any way you want. You can dance, you can skip, jump, doesn't matter. Come on home. We're over here waiting for you.
In the moment, I went ahead and embraced it, did a little dance, ran through, jumped over the threshold, and shook hands with all the welcoming people behind.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome home. That concludes our ceremony.
It's hard to explain. I do remember when they gave me a key, right, and it had said freedom, right, and they allowed us to take that freedom walk. It was just kind of just, that word was just kind of floating in my head, right? Freedom. Wow, I'm really free.
I didn't have a concept or idea what freedom was until it was gone. And when it's gone, when you're not able to make decisions for yourself and choices and just basically live, you learn to appreciate exiting of the dungeon and the ability to fly again. It's something special, and I will never, ever take for granted.
The room empties, and all that's left are a few people stacking chairs and someone dragging a suitcase of snacks out the door. The community will show up again next month for the same ceremony, and those who are welcomed home tonight will blend into a growing circle of support for the next batch coming home. For KCRW, I'm Lucy Kopp.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, at its peak, California had 173,000 prisoners in a system that was built to house about half that many. Prisoners were sleeping on top of each other, in hallways, in gyms. There were riots and attacks on guards that happened routinely. But in 2011, the Supreme Court decided that California's prison system amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. The state was then forced to reduce the number of prisoners. Realignment is what they called it. As Lucy just mentioned in her story, the reforms that followed here in California resulted in a lot more quote-unquote lifers, those folks you just heard, Jonathan and Louie, being released. Well, to talk a little bit more about what's happened and why and how, Heidi Rummel is a law professor at USC, where she also directs the Post-Conviction Justice Project. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Steve.
Give us a sense of the scope of the changes that we've seen over the past 8 years. I mean, you heard Lucy mention that a small handful of lifers would get out every year, and now the numbers are in the thousands?
That's correct. Prior to 2008, California's parole system was barely functioning. Very, very few lifers ever went home. The board could deny parole for almost no reason at all. In 2008, our project brought a case to the California Supreme Court that expanded judicial review of parole denials by both the board and the governor. And slowly but surely, people started going home, either through the parole process or through the courts. When Governor Brown came into office in 2011, he took a look at the broken parole process and recreated an administrative agency that was committed to sending people, lifers home who were safe, to release to the community. And the numbers started to increase even more. During that time frame, the legislature also passed a number of laws that affected youth offenders, people who committed crimes under age 26, and gave many, many people who had no chance of seeing a parole board in their natural lifetime the opportunity to go before a parole board and be released once they no longer posed a danger to the community. All of those changes created a lot of hope inside our prison system. People who went to prison young, with no chance of ever going home, don't have a lot of incentive to rehabilitate and change their lives.
Let's talk about young, because Louie, whom we just heard in the report, by the way, Louie is your client, right?
That's correct. My project at USC represented Louie at his parole hearings.
Right, right. He was 16 when he entered the criminal justice system, when he went to prison. He's now 40. And he told our reporter that he thought he was going to die there, behind bars. So for someone like Louis, who went in so young and now is a middle-aged man trying to make it in this economy, you know, I mean, what's it like adjusting to freedom and trying to adjust to the reality of life?
It's a difficult transition for almost everyone who comes home, who's grown up in prison culture and violence and dysfunction, to adjust to society, to reacclimate to family, reestablish relationships with family, establish relationships in general, enter the job market, support themselves, learn how to use a cell phone or a computer, or go to a grocery store and use a scanner. Everything is new. The parole process requires lifers to really do in-depth work on themselves. So they all come out with the great self-awareness, a commitment to positivity, and they have those tools. But the day-to-day life out here can be challenging and stressful for most people coming home after so many years in prison.
You mentioned recidivism, and that's still on a lot of people's minds. Crime is still at historic lows, but there's been a bump in some property crimes. In particular, since these reforms began, there are some efforts out there to try and roll back some of those reforms. Governor Newsom has even stepped in to stop some prisoners from being paroled. Are you concerned, do you think, that the state has moved too fast in this realm?
I think the state's forward progress has been fairly judicious. In the lifer population, the recidivism rate for violence is less than 1%, dramatically less than the general population's rate for violence. The recidivism rate for any offense, technical offenses, drug use, nonviolent offenses, missing probation or parole office appointments, is in the 3 to 4 to 5% range. Very, very, very few lifers are returned to prison. They are by and large successful in the community, more successful certainly than people coming home from prison who have not been released through that process and with a lower recidivism rate than the general public.
I mean, what's behind that, though? Is it you're thinking a lot? You certainly don't want to go through that again. You've been in prison for so long, you don't want to go back, certainly.
It's part of it. Criminal behavior decreases dramatically with advanced age and maturity, as science tells us and the common sense tells us. But the parole process in California is a very difficult needle to thread. The parole board is very exacting and demanding, and in 2-, 3-, 4-hour hearings examines every part of your life and assures themselves that you will not be a danger to the public before they make the decision to release you. And the governor reviews that decision. So the people coming home through that process are very successful. They struggle. It's a difficult transition, but they are ultimately successful. And my project has had more than 150 lifers released during the time we've been doing lifer hearings. Almost every one of them is giving back to their community in some meaningful way. So not only are they not recidivating and causing additional harms, they are mentoring at-risk youth, going back into prisons with me and my students to inspire other guys to change and do better, working with their churches, working in drug and alcohol counseling. Almost every client I've had and every lifer I know is doing something meaningful in their community.
One of the quotes that I heard in Lucy Kopp's piece was Louis, your client, who actually said, "I owe it to the victim to become a better person," or something along those lines. If you're a victim of crime, or if you're a family member of a victim of crime, say, you know, somebody who was killed, how do you jibe this? Like, you know, somebody getting out of prison, if they're like, "Oh man, you're not paying your full debt to society," what do you say to them?
Victims' perspectives vary greatly. There's no way to repay the debt of a lost life. There's no way to repay that. Some victims feel shortchanged by the changes in the system and people going home, although no one is going home before 25, 30 years in prison, almost no one. Some victims take peace and comfort in the fact that the person being released is genuinely remorseful about their crime and is committed to giving back and preventing future crimes like theirs in any way that they can. But I can't speak for every victim. The perspectives are varied in every way that people are varied.
Heidi Rummel, professor of law and director of the Post-Conviction Justice Project over at USC. Heidi, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Steve.
I want to give you an update on the fire that we have at Pacific Palisades this afternoon. Firefighters have been battling this one for a couple of hours now. More than 300 firefighters on the scene there. This is near North Palisades Drive around Sunset Boulevard. There are mandatory evacuations. A couple hundred homes evacuated in that area. And there is now an evacuation center. This is at the Palisades Recreation Center on Alma Real Drive in Pacific Palisades. So we'll keep you updated on that. That fire continues to burn, but those evacuations continue as well. and we'll have more details coming up on KCRW. Coming up on this program, we're talking about prison reform, people leaving the criminal justice system, how one public-private partnership in Orange County seeks to put a dent in the pipeline from mental illness to prison or hospital or homelessness. It's Greater LA. Welcome back and onward with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And now to Orange County, where officials say they're trying to break a troublesome cycle of the mentally ill who wind up in hospitals and jails. The county broke ground on what will be its first ever mental health treatment campus called Be Well OC. It'll have the capacity to serve about 15,000 people a year when it opens in January of 2021. Gustavo Arellano is here to tell us more about that project for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So we hear these stories in many places. There's a shortage of beds for mental health, which means patients suffering from mental health issues often, through their actions, enter the criminal justice system, or perhaps they enter hospitals. What is the county hoping this Be Well OC Center will do?
It's really yet the latest thing by the county to try to stop the homeless crisis. You know, the County of Orange, and also with private healthcare providers, with nonprofits, they're realizing, like, the big issue with homelessness and also is the fact that there is no facility or any really services for them that the county has offered in the past. In the past, if you were homeless on the streets or if you had mental issues and you harmed yourself or harmed others, the easy answer is, okay, just toss them into the jails. Toss them into the jails and more so and more so. Then, of course, in the jails, those problems get exacerbated. So really in the past couple of years, you've had these advocates going to the county, even going to the sheriff's department and saying, like, look, what we're doing now, it's only making the problem worse, which ends up creating more homeless people. So let's try to do something different. And that's the interesting thing. Like, in years past, the county has been very reticent, saying, oh, you know, it's not the job of the government to do these things. But now it's going to be a public-private partnership. So I think the county is really at its wit's end. But I think this is also a good step.
We'll talk about the public-private partnership of all of this, because we're talking millions of dollars. The county bought the property for about, well, just under $8 million. And then supervisors authorized how much? $28 million is the number that I'm seeing, right?
Yeah, that's the right figure. And you also have a lot of the county's private health centers, like, say, Kaiser and whatnot, Kaiser Permanente, Hoag Hospital and whatnot. They're also contributing money to create their own nonprofits. So the county, just, they're going to own the property. They're going to try to help with the other agencies, healthcare agency in Orange County and whatnot. But really, they want the people who know this best, which is going to be these hospitals, which is going to be these people who work with homeless folks and also with mental health people and people with drug addictions, to try to really make this into the nucleus for Orange County. County. And this is, if it goes well, the county is also looking to opening others across the county.
Is it going to be open to everyone, though? I mean, is it one of those places where you can just walk in and seek services?
That's the interesting thing. It's supposed to be the first one in the country in which anyone can go in and they don't have to pay. People who have no insurance, they're going to be covered by federal grants. People with insurance, it doesn't matter who your insurance provider is, you'll be able to get some sort of help one way or another. And that, I think, for Orange County, I mean, in a previous generation, they would call it socialism, but now I would just call it common sense.
You mentioned drug addiction and services such as that. There was a big drug bust last week. In Orange County, we're talking pounds and pounds of fentanyl, which is the synthetic opioid seized by authorities. Makes me wonder about where the opioid epidemic factors into this mental health approach. Do you think that plays into it as well?
We have to remember that the opioid crisis has nationwide, at least, been concentrated more so on the South and the East. We have yet to really get the full brunt of it. But the fact that you had that bust, and really in the past couple of years, you've had more and more overdoses in Orange County, shows also that the county officials realize, like, hey, we've been spared so far, but it's coming. It's spread all across the United States. So it's better to take a proactive approach than just let it happen and then us drowning in this, because that's what happened with the homelessness issue. In Orange County, you had both city and county officials saying, oh, there's not going to be any homelessness in Orange County. It's impossible. We're never going to have the problems that Los Angeles or other urban areas have. And what happened? You had the Santa Ana riverbed fiasco.
Gustavo Arellano, writer for the LA Times with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
And again, another quick update on the fire in Pacific Palisades. An evacuation center now up at the Recreation Center on Alma Real Drive. About 200 homes evacuated there. The fire continues to burn about 30-plus acres there. We'll keep you updated throughout the afternoon. We are out of time for today. Tomorrow, it's called the Arts District for a reason. How artists have made that industrial spot east of DTLA, HOT. Next on KCRW, it's The Business with Kim Masters. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Listen on your own time by subscribing to the podcast. You can also pitch your Greater LA stories there as well. Jenna Cagle, PJ Shahamat, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl are behind the broadcast and the podcast of this program. I'm Steve Chiatakis on a Monday. Thanks for your ear and for your time. Have a great day.